This is London calling. The British Broadcasting Corporation presents Alan Klein, president of the Iowa Farm Bureau, calling station WHO Des Moines. Once again, Mr. Klein is speaking direct from a BBC studio in London for Herb Plambeck's Corn Belt Farm Hour. Mr. Klein has spent 6 weeks in Britain touring the agricultural areas, and today we'll compare wartime farming here with farming in Iowa.
Hello, WHO, and hello again, Herb Plambeck. This is Alan Klein in London, bringing you another few minutes about Britain through the courtesy of the British Broadcasting Company. In the first place, a very rough comparison of Britain and Iowa. Its agriculture is somewhere near the size of Iowa's. We have, in fact, a few million more tilled acres in the state than there are in the whole of the United Kingdom. They, on the other hand, have a more intensive agriculture, and especially have more cattle and more dairying. It is quite probable that the total feed units in Iowa are higher. It even seems probable that the total human food produced is higher. The significance of 11 million acres of corn and a couple of million acres of soybeans in this respect is hard to overcome. The labor force of Britain in agriculture is approximately three times that of Iowa. But this single fact might easily lead to a false impression with regard to the efficiency of British agriculture. A considerable part of it is a result of the intensive aspect of different crops such as mangolds and swede turnips and potatoes and vegetables and sugar beets, things which require a very great deal of labor. Further, it is the sort of labor which it is difficult or impossible to replace by machinery. A considerable portion of the total farm work is done by employed labor. This makes wages of particular interest. And it is also of interest that minimum wages in Scotland are not the same as in the rest of the United Kingdom. The Scots have a unique setup. Their legislative representation is exactly the same as any other part of Britain. In the matter of administration, however, they have a Secretary of State and separate departments of education, of health, and of agriculture. And the administration of these affairs is decentralized. How far it is decentralized is shown by the fact that the recent discussion in Britain with regard to wages and prices in agriculture was of no moment in Scotland, since their wages had not been affected. On a very good farm in Scotland, these wages were actually being paid at the time I visited the farm. Ordinary men, $13 per week. Horsemen, $13.50 per week. The Scots think a great deal of their horses. Greaves, that is, bailiffs or farm managers, $15.20 per week. Shepherds, $15.20 per week. Their sheep are another thing they think a great deal of in this particular country. Women, $7.60 per week. In this case, as in most, there are some other perquisites. This same wage rate applies whether the women are regular workers or women's land army. On this farm, the owner greatly preferred his regular women workers, and many of them had been on the farm for years. The leader of a small band of women receives extra compensation, $4 every 6 months, in return for her special abilities. The minimum wage in Britain is slightly higher than in Scotland. On some farms, the minimum is paid, but on most farms, wages are a little above the minimum, which is required to be paid. A great many men are drawing in the neighborhood of $15 per week. The minimum wage for women's land army is $9.60 per week. Many of these stay in hostels and pay approximately half their wages for board. Some of them, of course, draw slightly more, which I have been told may be done at the discretion of the employer. The highest priced man whom I have discovered here was a bailiff, that is, a farm manager, who is responsible for operations on one of a certain farmer's four farms and who receives $22 per week and a bonus dependent upon farm profits. Last year, he actually received $1,520 in cash and some other considerations. This was very exceptional. On the whole, real wages of farm labor here seem lower than those we know at home. On this same farm in Scotland, where I have gathered the above wage rates, they were threshing the day I was there. The machine was built into the barn. Grain was being hauled in one-horse carts from one of numerous stacks still left on the farm. In fact, the farmer does not expect to finish threshing until May. There were a total of 14 people working at the job. Three were hauling in grain, one was pitching bundles up to the top of the machine, two women were cutting bands and handing alternately a bundle to a man who fed it by hand to the machine. Two women were gathering up chaff in a huge burlap at the end of the machine and carrying it away to bedpens of feeding cattle. Two women and a boy were carrying the bundles of straw, which are tied at one end of the machine with a binding device, the same as used in grain binders, and throwing it up on a platform where an additional man pitched it up to a stack and a final fellow was putting it away so it would shed water. Oh, yes, and I forgot. One man was upstairs catching the grain in sacks and carrying it back to storage in the upstairs of the barn. In some other areas, modern combines are satisfactory, and their use is growing. On the matter of prices, there is a very mixed situation. The greatest portion of agricultural production is bought and distributed at fixed prices and under strict government control. On the whole, prices are such that farming is profitable. Quite profitable. In fact, no one worries much about prices. I remember asking a district officer of one of the War Agricultural Executive Committees what kind of fertilizer he was going to apply to a certain crop. He replied that he didn't know. Everything of that sort was rationed. I then asked him how much it cost ton, and he replied that he was sorry but didn't know. It didn't really matter anyway. This is all a reflection of the fact that production and distribution of food in Britain now is the thing, and that prices and profits are incidental. There is one notable exception to this uniform price thing. The prices of full-blood livestock are out of sight. I find in my notes that 60 head of Ayrshire cows, the total number sold at a recent sale, averaged $2,220 each. The top cow in the sale brought something over $8,800. The Ayrshire breed is the chief offender. However, at his sale a year ago, one breeder of purebred hogs averaged $256 for gilts, and a breeder of Border Leicester sheep averaged $176 for his ram lambs at the sale last fall. There is trouble ahead in the purebred livestock business. It is worth noting that the price of land is rising dramatically. And carts. No description of British farming could be accurate without mentioning carts. There are carts everywhere. Most of them are high-wheeled, small carts with shafts, generally one horse, sometimes two, but if two, driven or led tandem. These carts are used for all sorts of things, for feeding stock, for hauling supplies around the farm, for moving grain from the stack to the machines, and for hauling out manure from the buildings to the field. Some of them have been modernized and have rubber tires, and a few have tractor hitches and become a modern sort of trailer with self-dump. Manure spreading here is a most astonishing thing. On very up-to-date farms, I have seen them hauling manure into a pile with a wheelbarrow, loading it on a high cart by hand, carting it to the fields and pulling it out the back of the cart in small piles, and later spreading it by hand. In most instances, in wartime, this is a woman's job, spreading manure from the piles. Farms are all shapes and all sizes. There are areas in Britain where the farms are larger than any comparable area in Isle. On the Chalk in Wiltshire, they average 600 acres. On the other hand, I am told, the average farm in Britain is 100 acres. There are considerable areas where for a whole administrative district, the size is 50 acres. Fields, likewise, are all sizes and all shapes. In some of the fully mechanized areas, they run 30, 40, or even up to 70 or 80 acres or more. The average field, however, is much smaller than ours. They are divided by hedges and surrounded by hedges. These hedges are something. One afternoon, I attended a hedge-laying competition. The competitors were members of the Young Farmers Club. The hedgerow is cleaned of trees and undesirable shrubs, and the hawthorn is cut close to the ground except the live bark on one side. It is then tipped over at an angle so that it will grow again from the bottom and make a thick hedge. The boys were required to lay 8 yards in 5 hours. This will give you some idea of the terrific expense of hedge laying. Many people give different estimates of the cost. One man estimated it as low as $220 to $250 per mile. He indicated, however, that they should be laid every 7 or 8 years. Another estimated the cost at $400 per mile. He, however, indicated that they should be laid every 10 or 12 years. In addition, if the hedge is kept in good repair, it must be trimmed annually. This costs $20 or $25 per mile. When you consider that half the hedges as trimmed would not turn cattle in the winter and would never turn pigs, it does seem to me that British hedges are something of a phenomenon. This doesn't mean that they have no economic value. They sometimes protect drainage ditches, they are often well used to prevent wind erosion, and they furnish stock protection. But I am also quite certain that if they didn't contribute to what the British call the amenities of country life, there would be very few of them. They must be very beautiful in the spring and summer. Very beautiful indeed. One thing about this farming business here, it is a permanent agriculture. There is no erosion, or practically none. This is something for Iowa to take note of. It is not a result of management, it is the character of the rainfall. There is no such thing here as a washing rain. Steep slopes may be farmed with amenity. This is an old agriculture. They use heavy applications of commercial fertilizers on most of the fields all of the time. It is not at all unusual to have a regular application of 300 pounds of very high content complete commercial fertilizer applied to grain crops. That is, providing they can get it. Potash is short, and all fertilizers strictly rationed according to need. There are some projects where in order to grow grain since this war came in, applications have been made of 1,120 pounds of basic slag per acre and 240 pounds of sulfate of ammonia per acre. In the latter case, however, it was utterly useless land and is now growing unbelievable quantities of grass after having produced an excellent crop of oats. Mechanization is mixed. It was sparse and poor before the war. Now it is the significant power behind Britain's wartime food production. It is handicapped a little by the fact that there are all makes of machines, British, Australian, Canadian, and American. Another point, yields here are remarkable. They are very much higher than before the war. The look ahead is most interesting. British farming has unbelievably improved since the war and has a good chance to continue to improve. The war agricultural executive committees have done the impossible. Payments have cooperated in a way one has to see to believe. The new rotations with temporary grass pastures bid fair to double agricultural output permanently. Agriculture here is permanent, and it has high yields. It has an immediate market for more than it can produce. As far as post-war is concerned, the British farmer hopes to maintain a fair position in that market, and is desperately desirous of close cooperation with agriculture in other countries through a foreign policy designed to promote goodwill and mutual prosperity.
You've been listening to Alan Klein, president of the Iowa Farm Bureau, speaking from a London studio of the British Broadcasting Corporation.